South Africa has declared a national disaster to face a dire energy crisis. The president says it's a threat to the economy and the nation's social fabric. But is this move enough? And what caused the emergency in the first place? This is Inside Story. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Mohammed Jamjoum. South Africa has been experiencing one of the worst energy crises in the region in years. It's affecting millions of people across the country. The nation's aging coal-powered electrical stations are not coping with demand, and it's leading to daily blackouts that can sometimes last for hours. For patients on life support, it's a stressful time, especially when electricity doesn't come on as scheduled. In some farms, animals are dying before reaching the slaughterhouse. Opposition politicians and demonstrators have blamed the governing ANC party. President Cyril Ramaphosa declared a state of disaster on Friday while emphasizing his government's efforts to transition to cleaner energy.
The National Disaster Management Center has consequently classified the energy crisis and its impact as a disaster. We are therefore declaring a national state of disaster to respond to the electricity crisis and its effect. We will continue our just transition to a low-carbon economy at a pace our country is able to keep up with, and at a pace we can afford, and in a manner that ensures energy security. We will undertake our just transition in a way that opens up the possibility of new investments, new industrialization, and that, above all, creates new jobs.
The sustained load shedding, as it's known in South Africa, is putting at risk the nation's economic stability. The most simple daily tasks like cooking, travel, or working have to be planned around power outages. Some businesses that rely heavily on electricity to produce their goods and services have gone bankrupt. This includes modern farming, which is putting food supplies at risk. And unreliable power supplies are worrying investors, which in return affects economic growth. All right, let's go ahead and bring in our guests. They're all joining us from South Africa today. In Johannesburg, Kenneth Creamer, an economic advisor to the ANC's Economic Transformation Committee. In Gqeberha, formerly known as Port Elizabeth, Ongama Mtimka, a lecturer at the Nelson Mandela University. And also in Johannesburg is Chris Yelland, an energy analyst. A warm welcome to you all, and thanks for joining us today on Inside Story. Ongama, let me start with you today. Our topic is essentially the power crisis that's going on in South Africa. As I understand it, you don't have much battery left on your phone right now, and you don't have electricity. So I want to ask you about how dire the situation is currently in South Africa when it comes to all these power outages, when it comes to the energy crisis.
The situation is very dire. The South Africa is the most industrialized country in the continent, and the cities in some of the poorest provinces that attract a lot of jobs. Manufacturing cities. The city of Gqeberha is an automotive hub in the country, also known as the Detroit of South Africa. Likewise, the city of East London. With these continuing load shedding, they serve as a battering ram against the sustainable economies of these cities. And it's been for such a long time, and the problem seems intractable when it comes to both those that are acting within the confines of the state utility company Eskom, but also the politicians that are meant to enable the work of Eskom, starting from the party to the level of the president and his ministers.
Ongama, I want to continue on with you in case we lose you. There is a concern about that. So let me follow up with you and ask you, this declaration of a national disaster to face this energy crisis by President Ramaphosa, from your vantage point, is that actually going to be enough?
In order to lead during a time of a crisis, you need to give the leaders a degree of latitude to be able to take bold decisions and also to act faster. In South Africa, being a democracy, that hardly happens. Unlike China, where if the government says we're going to build a port there and everybody must move, in South Africa, you've got too many interested groups that lobby against particular course of actions. And in a country like ours, where we are operating in crisis mode, you cannot afford to have some of the cumbersome processes that are there. I do accept the critique by those who are critical of this stance to say, we shouldn't have been in this place in the first place. We should have been incrementally solving the problem. However, we find ourselves in a crisis. And I think that a state of disaster that does allow the government some latitude from a rules and procedures point of view. But we do know that that does open up the procurement to potential corruption. And unfortunately, a government like ours that faces a credibility crisis is going to struggle to convince South Africans about the need. But I think that we need to have that state of disaster, national disaster, so that you could have a framework of taking actions that are targeted towards resolving the problem without being bogged down by some of the ordinary rules and procedures that bind government procurement and infrastructure delivery in the country.
Kenneth.
And also to protect. So in anticipation of the public outcry for the potential procurement, the president did announce that they are going to rope in the Auditor General, and that the Auditor General is an office of high repute. It's a Chapter 9 institution that supports democracy. And it does give a little bit of comfort that notwithstanding the permissible environment for corruption and looting, the role of the Auditor General is going to be quite instrumental in giving assurance to stakeholders that the ANC is not about creating a blank check for it to loot state resources and not deliver on the energy that we need.
Kenneth, President Ramaphosa called the energy crisis in his State of the Nation address an existential threat to the economy and the social fabric of our country. But you also heard Ongama there talking about the fact that the ANC has a credibility crisis. I'm curious to know, from your vantage point, why was this not dealt with more before now? Why did it have to get to this point? And how much is the current situation imperiling the country?
Yes, thank you very much. I agree with much of what Ongama has said about the declaration of the state of disaster. But you asked some very important questions. The effect that this is having on our economy, whether we declare it a state of disaster or not, is pretty disastrous. We have high unemployment, which is made worse by the lack of electricity. The gross domestic fixed investment levels are lower than they have been and haven't really recovered since before the COVID crisis back to those levels. So investment is difficult. There is some investment taking place by firms investing in their own electricity supplies. The laws have been changed to allow for firms to do that. And also now households are going to be incentivized to be able to buy their own solar panels, etc. So there is some investment, but it's really investment in response to the load shedding rather than investment in new factories, new mines, new farms, etc. So the truth of the matter is that we do know what needs to be done to overcome this electricity crisis. The ANC government has put together a plan in July last year, an energy action plan, which has got short-term, medium-term, and long-term interventions. I think the problem is that this electricity crisis has been building up for so many years, and proper attention has not been paid to it. But I think with the declaration of this state of disaster, with the energy plan now being given that extra impetus, we will begin to turn the corner, and we will be able to start to institute those reforms that are needed. I think also what is needed is a unity of purpose in implementing those reforms. Unfortunately, when you have a crisis, and as Ongama says, people are pulling in opposite directions, I do believe that the ANC will be able to unite the country, both business, labor, and communities, around a program under the president's leadership which will be able to begin to address this electricity crisis for once and for all. It's a very deep crisis, and it's going to take some years to overcome, but we will begin to see the beginning of, well, there have already been a number of interventions. As I said, businesses are now allowed to invest in their own capacity. Households will be allowed to, first of all, get tax incentives for the solar panels that they buy. And in future, some councils, there will be feed-in tariffs where they can begin to feed into the grid. Just to summarize it, there's two pillars to this. The one is to bring as much generation capacity on stream as quickly as possible. And the second is to improve the performance of the Eskom power stations. Thank you.
Kenneth, let me just continue in this vein, because, you know, we're talking about this state of disaster that is being implemented now. Of course, there was a state of disaster that was also implemented during the COVID pandemic. And there were many critics of that, and they said that there were a lot of people that had been abusing those emergency measures. Clearly, there is a concern about the potential for corruption when it comes to these measures. President Ramaphosa has said that he anticipates potential corruption and that measures are going to be put in place to prevent that from happening. What might some of those measures be?
Yes, you're quite right. There is skepticism. Funnily enough, some of the political parties that actually called for the ANC and the government to implement the state of the disaster are now suddenly getting cold feet and are threatening to take it to court. So there's a lot of flip-flopping involved. And because there is this concern, during the COVID crisis, many countries around the world had to do extraordinary things to respond to that crisis. In South Africa, some of those extraordinary things proved to be very effective. You know, the vaccine rollout, closing schools, closing businesses temporarily. It was negative on the economy, but it was driven by the public health imperatives. So those were the good public health outcomes that we had. Unfortunately, there were people who took advantage and stole from the public, unbelievably so, in the period of a crisis like that. As Ogama has said, when the president announced this state of disaster, he responded to that fear, that legitimate fear, to say this, there will be an oversight of this process by the Auditor General to make sure that we are able to not allow people to steal or to do corrupt things. The main advantages of this, the state of disaster, would be that we can accelerate procurement, we can increase the security and prosecution of those who have been disrupting the work of Eskom, and also just to have that unity of purpose around the plans that are in place. We need to centralize around the plans of the government to solve this problem and move together. And I think that the state of disaster signals that that unity of purpose can be achieved.
Chris, I want to talk for a moment about what the power shortages, what this energy crisis means for the economy, especially, and for overall economic growth in South Africa. I mean, how much, let's just take one example, how much worse does the situation get for small businesses?
Now, look, you know, the level of load shedding that we experience, you know, in technical terms is called stage one, stage two, stage three, or whatever. In practical terms, it reflects in the number of hours that we go without power per day. So for the lower stages of load shedding, one might go without power for 2 hours or 4 hours a day. When you reach stage four load shedding, you're going at about 6 hours of loss of power per day. And at stage six, you're going at about 8 to 10 hours of without power. So the level of disruption depends on the severity of the load shedding underway. And it is, of course, very disruptive. At lower levels, people learn to cope with these lower levels of load shedding. It's only a few hours a day, and one can work around it. And one gets to regard these lower levels of load shedding as the kind of new normal. When you get to the higher levels of load shedding, stage five, stage six, where you're looking at 8 to 10 hours of load shedding a day, the economic impacts are incredibly severe. So it's not a linear relationship between the level of load shedding and the amount of economic disruption. In fact, it's kind of an exponential relationship. The higher the load shedding, you get dramatically more impact on the economy, to the extent where some businesses just cannot operate. They cannot actually work around the and you get this loss of, for example, livestock, disruptions to supply chains, water supply chains, food supply chains, etc. And the disruption to the economy, you know, can be estimated. But what is hard to estimate is the loss of opportunities, investment opportunities, those investments that do not get made or that walk away because South Africa is seen as an unreliable destination in respect of electricity, and many industries do rely on a continuous electricity supply for survival. So the economic impacts are felt far and wide, from the individual level through to small business, medium business, and process industries, of course, feel it very significantly because they rely on a 24-hour day continuous operation.
And Chris, if I could just follow up with you, I mean, when you're talking about on the individual level, I mean, how does something like this have an impact on, let's say, unemployment? There's the high unemployment rates right now in South Africa, especially youth unemployment rates. So how is that impacting, you know, the unemployment rates across the country?
It is significant because electricity at the moment is not acting as a lubricant to the economy. The lack of electricity is acting as an inhibitor to economic growth. So it is inhibiting expansion of business. Our growth rate in South Africa is remarkably low for a developing country, to the extent where the growth in GDP in South Africa is less than the growth of the population. And therefore, the per capita GDP is actually declining and has been declining for several years. And people are getting poorer. That is the net effect. On average, people are getting poorer. And a significant part of this slow growth environment that we experience is the constraints on the economy that a lack of electricity or inadequate supply of electricity causes. And we see this, the effect is this going without power for many hours a day, which impacts on economic activity in the country.
Ongama, first of all, I'm glad that you're still with us. Let me ask you about something that Kenneth mentioned a few minutes ago. He was talking about the fact that there are opposition politicians or parties that are not happy about the about these emergency measures that are going to be put in place. So I want to ask, from your perspective, where do things stand across the political spectrum when it comes to the declaration? And will those who are opposed to these measures actually be able to block it, whether it be through a court challenge or other political machinations?
So I think the best way to read the political environment for our response to the crisis is not looking at the constitutive parts of our political system, but the cumulative impact of all the players and the effect that they have. Opposition parties in themselves do not have power in the cabinet or in parliament in order to make a significant stoppage to a program of government. However, in that nexus between executive conduct and the law, or politics and the law, they at instances find an opportunity where they can leverage a particular legal provision in order to stop a process. Otherwise, that then helps augment their power. When you compare that with the lobby groups that are interested, and I think it was Kenneth was talking about the various interests and the need for unity of purpose, there are lobby groups who are wanting South Africa's pace of transitioning to cleaner energies to happen in a way that begins to threaten the justness of that transition. In terms of that, for example, from those things that he mentioned in terms of how we need to address the problem, there is a role for making sure that the last of what our coal-fired power stations have in the short term is leveraged while managing a build program and ensuring that in the short term, you're also, addressing the longer term challenges. We have a situation in which there's a complex web of relations that serve to derail the agenda of dealing in good faith with our crisis in ways that are focused on what our problems are, that is energy insecurity, and the best way to deal with it through the entire mix of solutions that we have. So what makes the political environment a lot more complex is not necessarily the action of opposition parties alone, but also the web of relationships which are interested economically in this, both from the ANC and from outside, that make our job a lot more difficult.
President Ramaphosa has also said that he's going to appoint a minister of electricity with full responsibility for overseeing all aspects of the electricity response. When is that going to be done?
Yes, I'm not quite sure when that is going to be done. He announced it in the State of the Nation address on Thursday night. And I think it was an intervention from his part, if we can read between the lines, to try and ensure that he's able to bring all the members of his government and all the members of his political party into alignment with regard to implementing his energy action plan. So I'm sure he will be doing it pretty speedily, and it will be announced when he's ready to announce it. So, but as Ogamo is saying, there's an energy transition that is taking place throughout the world, in all countries. Energy is changing, the technology is changing. In South Africa, we have a particular program of a just energy transition, which is saying, well, there are certain people that are going to be affected negatively in the coal-producing regions, and those people who are negatively affected need to have pathways towards new employment and towards new economic activity. But I do believe that one of the consequences of the severity of this load shedding is that we're going to accelerate the just energy transition in South Africa. It is the way out of our energy crisis to bring new solar and wind and battery and other technologies as quickly and as cheaply onto the grid as possible, like they did in Vietnam, allowing it to happen from the bottom up and the top down by ensuring that firms and households can do it as well. So I think that one of the you asked earlier why it's taken so long. It's taken so long because we have not had unity of purpose on this just energy transition. There was even a time when the leadership of Eskom cancelled a program of bringing on solar and wind projects. They said it wasn't needed. It was a major error that was made under that rogue leadership at that time. So I do think a consequence of this now having a new minister to implement this plan is to accelerate that energy transition as the shortest path out of our energy crisis.
Chris, from your point of view, you were laying out all the challenges to the economy right now. From your point of view, will the government actually be able to do this on its own, or is the private sector going to need to be involved?
Yeah, first of all, to answer that specifically, there is, in my opinion, no possibility that the public procurement processes and government can address this problem in the short term. Government processes are and procurement processes and large mega projects and sorting out Eskom are longer term activities. And in the short term, the solutions are going to come from the customers of electricity through self-generation, embedded generation, distributed generation, and a massive rollout of rooftop solar PV and battery energy storage in domestic, commercial, and agricultural sectors. That's where the quick wins will come from. And the role of government in this environment is to put out the right economic signals and incentives to enable the private sector and customers of electricity to respond quickly. Because in this way, literally hundreds of thousands of individuals, small businesses, medium businesses, large businesses, mines can respond to these economic signals simultaneously instead of trying to micromanage major projects which take a long time. I believe that the role of government in the short term is to put out the right economic signals. I just want to touch on points that are raised by Terence Creamer, and I do appreciate his optimism and this idea that people need to work together, and especially in government. And we often criticize opposition for being divisive, but in fact, the real divisions are happening within the ruling party and within government. And I have a concern that the appointment of this new Minister of Electricity in the presidency is adding an extra layer of complexity to the government governance structures of electricity, which are already very onerous. So at the moment now, right, with this new ministry, There is now three ministries involved in electricity. That's the Department of Mineral Resources and Energy, Department of Public Enterprises, Department of Electricity, this new one. And of course, there's two indirect ones. That is the National Treasury and responsible for money, and the COGTA responsible, for intergovernmental governance. And so you have five ministries involved, and it would be good if they were all of a common purpose, as Kenneth pointed out, and working in the same direction. Mm. But the reality is not. They are not. They are often at war with each other, finger pointing against each other, criticizing each other publicly. They have different agendas, and they are all pulling in different directions.
Chris, I'm sorry.
And in that environment, it's very hard to see how this will bring immediate action fast.
Right. Chris, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we are running out of time. I first want to mention that we have lost Ongama. He ran out of battery and does not have power. So that really goes to show how dire the situation is in South Africa. Kenneth, we only have about a minute and a half left. I want to give you a chance to respond to what Chris was saying. He was essentially mentioning his concern that basically he's saying there's too much bureaucracy. There's too many ministries involved in this. Is that going to get any better?
Look, I think it is a valid concern. We live in a democracy in South Africa, so there's a lot of voices. It's very vocal, which is a good thing. We have courts that can check whether government is doing things properly and can go and review. So we have a free media. So these are all positive things that we do have. But unfortunately, government has become from dysfunctional at times. We had a period of what is known as state capture, grand corruption, where state agencies were repurposed by people with criminal intent. And I think the president has spent some time in rebuilding the police intelligence structures, the prosecuting authorities, and there is some progress being made to clean up the government. Mm. But I think what Chris is talking about is a bit of a deeper issue regarding the unity around a vision for solving the energy crisis. And I do believe we'll only be able to judge this by the fruits. Mm. If the president is correct, and by appointing a minister in his office to bang the heads together and to bring everyone together, then I think we'll be able to judge whether that is successful in the months ahead.
All right. Well, we have run out of time, so we are going to have to leave the conversation there. Thanks so much to all of our guests, Kenneth Creamer, Ongama Mthimkhe, and Chris Yelland. And thank you, too, for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. For me, Mohammed Mjoum, and the whole team here in Doha, bye for now.